Okay, here we go. Welcome to the third class in Journey of the Soul. I hope everyone is enjoying the series as much as I am. And so the past 2 weeks in advance, we've been discussing the Jewish approach to death. And once we understand it, then we can go about preparing for it. But I have a feeling that these next few classes, this week and next week, is the reason why a lot of you have come. Because the next two classes are going to deal with what happens when we die. What happens to the soul? What happens to the body? And it's going to be kind of a two-part series this week and next week. Like I said, if you missed a class, we're recording it, video and audio. So also, if you're going out of town, we want to try to use as much technology as possible. You can call into Google Hangouts. Can download the app. It's free. It's like a video conference, and you can join the class if for whatever reason you're not here. Now, so this week we're going to deal with what happens down here when the soul separates from the body, and next week we'll talk about what happens up there when the soul goes on and you see the light. And so tonight's class is going to divide into four parts. Number one, we'll discuss the spiritual significance of a person's passing. Second, we're going to talk about the process of the soul's departure from the body. Then, number three, we're going to examine the Jewish tradition around burial. They tell the story of a rabbi who comes to a synagogue, and in the courtyard he sees a dead donkey. So he thinks it's a hate crime. So he calls the cops. Cops say, sorry, donkey in your courtyard doesn't qualify as a hate crime. So what should I do? So call the sanitation department. They call the sanitation department and they say, we don't pick up dead donkeys. Call the health department. It might be a public hazard. So call the public hazard. Call the public health department. And they say, sorry, dead donkey is not really a public hazard. Try calling the mayor. So calls the mayor. The mayor is having a bad day, and he's speaking very curt and very annoyed with the rabbi. He says, you're the rabbi. You deal with dead people all the time. He says, aren't you supposed to take care of burials? Isn't that your area of expertise? He said, yeah, but before we bury, we always notify the next of kin. Right? So we're talking about Jewish burial, and last we'll talk about visiting the grave. Okay. So in the first part, we explained that the soul and the body are two different entities. And what happens when the soul departs from the body, it's a new beginning. Now the soul can begin a new journey. Now it's not connected, it's untethered, and the soul is no longer attached to the body, so it doesn't have the problems it had with bills and everything that happens when the soul leaves the body. So the question we're first going to deal with is, what happens when the soul leaves the body? We're going to start with a letter from the Alter Rebbe of Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with who the Shneur Zalman is or was, let me give you a brief history of Hasidic history. I'll try to make it very short. The first Hasidic rabbi was the Baal Shem Tov Yisrael Baal Shem. He was succeeded by his student, the Rav Dover, the Maggid of Mezrich. The Maggid of Mezrich passed away in 1772. This is Russia, nothing to do with the War of Independence. No. And I know in America we think this is the only country in the world, right? Nothing exists outside. That's not true. Right? Russia existed back then too. So the most senior student of the Maggid, Rav Dover, was Rav Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk, which is a small town. He became the Hasidic Rebbe. After a few years, he decided to make Aliyah to Israel. And in 1777, he made Aliyah. He passed away in 1778. So the Hasidic movement was bereft of a spiritual leader. Just 6 years before, they lost one teacher. Now they lost another teacher. And Shneur Zalman, who was the youngest of the Maggid students, he penned a letter of comfort to all the Hasidic people out there. But before we read the letter, you first have to understand some things that the Alter Rebbe discusses in the letter. So you see on page 96. Wrong way. Oh. Oh, I guess we'll do it. Ah, we did it. Okay. On page 96, you're going to see figure 3.1, which discusses the soul. Well, the soul really has five components. I don't know how many of you have learned some Kabbalah. I don't want you to say, my rabbi is an idiot. That's not the reason why I'm an idiot. The soul really has five components. Tonight we're going to be discussing two of them. The other three are not relevant to tonight's discussion, so if you have any questions, you can ask by email or later, and to explain how those tie in. But tonight we're going to be discussing two of those components. Number one is nefesh and ruach. A lot of these terms you're going to hear are always interchanged, and people always use the same. Nefesh means life force. So your biological self is powered by the fact that you exist is your nefesh. That powers your physical self. Your ruach, means, any of you speak Hebrew, ruach? What does ruach mean?
Wind.
Or spirit. Okay, ruach does mean wind, that's true, but also means spirit. So your spirit, your personality, your emotion, and your feelings, that is ruach. So let me give you an example. When you go to sleep, interestingly, the Talmud said, when you go to sleep, you're 1/60th dead. When you go to sleep, biologically you're there. You're functioning. I'm not a doctor, but right, you're alive. At least, unless you're a teenager, and your father's trying to wake you up to go to shul. Then, tight. Right? I know, I've been there. My father poured cold water, the whole nine yards. So when you're sleeping, you're biologically there. But you speak to a person, they can't answer. And why? Because they're unconscious. You asked me something about anesthesia, but that's, again, October. That's why we brought it up. So very similarly, when a person is alive, they have these two fundamental life forces in them. They have the nefesh, which powers their physical life force. And then they have the ruach. Okay, now we can move on to... Now we can move on to text 1A, page 97. Oh, there you go. Oh, okay. The Rabshneir Zalman of Liadi writes like this. As is known, page 97, it's a lengthy letter. As is known, the life of a tzaddik, the Rabshneir Zalman is discussing a tzaddik, but really applies to everybody. The life of a tzaddik is not physical, but spiritual. It consists of faith, and every Jew has faith. Reverence, and every Jew has fear and love of God. While a tzaddik is alive on earth, these three attributes are comprised of the ruach and the nefesh. So what he's saying here, I'm going to cut it in short because it's a lengthy text. Please, you read it inside. Is that your personality is vested... is enclosed in your nefesh. It means your ruach, your personality, is enclosed in your biological self. So in order for me to get in touch with your personality, I have to be where you're physically present. Does that make sense? So wherever you are physically, that's where I can communicate with you, with your personality. Okay? So if you want to connect to a holy person or to any person, you have to go to where they are physically. Because their personality is trapped. We'll use the word trapped because you'll see why in a moment. Is trapped where they are physically. But what happens when a person passes away, their physical self or the biological self and their personality self are separated. So the nefesh part stays in the grave, as Shneur Zalman writes. The nefesh part, the biological self, stays in the grave. And the ruach part, the emotions and the attributes... that's not tied down to anything physical, and that goes to the Garden of Eden. That goes to heaven. Before I go on, any questions? Is this understood? Because this is very important for the continuation of the lesson. Okay. Making sure that... So, your ruach is not limited. Is not confined. And this is kind of an abstract idea, but think of it like this. And all of us, I mean, I don't know if they have little kids, but they had little kids. Right? You try to teach a kid math. You say, you have two apples, and you have two apples. And you show the kid four apples. So I have two apples and two apples. How many apples do I have? The kid counts one. Right? Four apples. Now you take the kid into the other room. You say, how many apples did I have in the other room? kid looks at you like, what are you talking about? Because they only understand the concrete. As a person grows older, they can understand abstract ideas. Right? So the same thing is, as we mature, we understand of a truth that's not necessarily concrete in front of our face. So if you ask a person in Australia, what's 2 plus 2? Although it's below the equator and the water flushes the other way and all the things, the terrible things we say about Australians, they're going to say 4. Right? Because the truth is the truth. The truth is not limited to a space. The same thing is your ruach is not your personality. It's not limited to your confined physical space. During when you're a person is alive on earth, so then it's confined to where that person is. But then when a person passes away, now it's accessible. This is a very important word. It's accessible by anybody who has a connection with that person. In this case of the Shneur Zalman, he's talking about a holy person. Now, the unique thing about holy people is that because they pay so little attention to their physical self, and they're so much attention to their spiritual self, so even when they're alive, people can connect to them in a spiritual way. I'm going to tell you 2 stories. One of them, the link is actually in the email going out after class. And the other one, I heard it from the person. It's on the video. I have to crop the video. 2 stories, if time allows it. One is the story of Mendel Futterfass. I'm going to tell the story very short. Mendel Futterfass was a Russian troublemaker. He was arrested by the Russian authorities back in the 30s or 40s for helping Jews to escape Russia. And he went through a very, very hard time, and they interrogated him, and he didn't see his wife for 17 years. And in the last Farbringen is Yiddish for a get-together, Hasidic gathering, the last Farbringen, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the previous Rebbe, said the words, "If you think of me, I will think of you." That's what he said. See, here's Mendel Futterfass with the picture of him over there. He's in Siberia, and he decides he wants to write a letter, send a telegram to the Rebbe. Now, in Russia, if you're in Siberia, you have no rights. You're nothing. So he penned a letter to the Rebbe in his head. His wife is in Israel. She gets a letter, and again, this is in the video, you will see a copy of this letter. I'm not exaggerating. She gets a letter saying, regarding the telegram in which I received, in which you state this problem, that problem, that problem, she could not understand the meaning of this letter. She never sent such a letter. She never had such a problem. It was only when Mendel Futterfass came out of prison, out of Siberia, and after 17 years they reunited, they understood. That's story number one. Story number two is not even so long ago. The story number two is in the late 70s, early 80s. There's a shliach in Ashbury, Connecticut, I think the city is called. His name is Yisrael Dern. And right after he moved on Shlichus, he decided to make a big concert, a Jewish unity event. And he rented a big hall, over 1,000 seats, and he thought it's going to be great. This concert was Sunday night. Friday before the concert, he calls and he expects to hear 800 seats were sold. 87 seats. And he says, that's it. I came only a few months ago, and I'm a complete failure. And he feels depressed, and he feels that's it. How can I show myself to the Rebbe? I'm the Rebbe's messenger, and I'm a complete disaster. And that Shabbos, he was thinking of the story of Ramendel Futterfass, and he said, if I was a chassid, if I was a person like Ramendel, I would send a letter to the Rebbe, and I would ask him for a blessing. Sunday morning, there's a line outside the hall, standing room only. Rabbi Yisrael Deren's grandparents were at the concert, and right afterward, they raced back to Crown Heights because they had a private audience with the Rebbe. The Rebbe asked Rabbi Yisrael, so how was the concert? How many people came? And the grandmother says, it was a tremendous success. And the Rebbe says, you see? And yesterday, Yisrael was all depressed and worried. That was on Shabbos, no letter. We're trying to say that the connection we can have to a person is not necessarily through a physical touch, or it necessarily has to be something physical, concrete. There's a level of connection that we can have to people that go beyond the physical and into the realms of the intangible. And you can see in text 1b, it is known that the effort of man that has soul toiled during his lifetime remains in a hidden state. So this kind of explains how come we don't see the impact of a mitzvah. When we do a mitzvah, we don't see the impact in this world. Now that we all have HD television, right? I was driving by a few weeks ago and I saw some guy put on the curb, you know, one of those big old TVs with the big, what do you call it, behind? And I said, for free! No one took it. So let's say you have one of those big TVs and you're trying to get an HD signal. You can't. You're not equipped. The same thing is, this world we're not equipped to be in tune to what the spiritual realities really are. So when a rabbi comes over to you and says, you should do a mitzvah, like put on tefillin, and you're thinking to yourself, I don't feel it. What gain do I have from putting on tefillin? You're using the wrong wiring. You're not using the right antenna. It's kind of like an inside trader comes to you and says, I got a inside tip. The stock Apple, it's going to be huge. I just sound like Donald Trump, right? It's going to be huge, right? Right? So, and you're thinking, what does this guy know? At the time, you don't realize what it is. Later, you get an understanding. And this is what happens when a person passes away. And this, in the Alter Rebbe, Shneur Zalman, writes it regarding a tzaddik. But we said once, every Jew is a tzaddik. Every Jew has an element of righteousness inside of him. So although that text is about a tzaddik, it applies to every single person. We all have that ability to be accessible to loved ones. So the more love we have, the more accessible we are. Does that make sense? The more we try to attach to that person and get in touch with what that person really likes, the more we'll feel attached. And this kind of explains, maybe, you know, there's two portions in the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, that's called Achrimot Kedoshim. And they're always read, usually read together. Achrimot means after they die, Kedoshim, they're holy. So it's always, what?
It's not 27.
It's not Leviticus 27, no. So there's an old joke that, you know, we don't speak bad about anyone after they pass away. Why? Because Achrimot, after they die, Kedoshim. Why not? How come we don't speak bad about people after they die? Out of respect? If a guy's a bad guy, he's a bad guy. The reason why we don't speak bad about people is because once a person passes away, we forget about the negative stuff. And because their positive side is so much more accessible, it's so much more powerful, so now we can only remember the positive things. And also the heart, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Does this make sense? Okay. Or there's still people you want to speak bad about. Okay. So now, I'm a little lax here. So at the moment of death, all a person's spiritual energy is unleashed and revealed to itself and to its loved ones. That means even the mitzvahs you do, you're more in touch with yourself after a person passes away. Because as a physical self, you can appreciate a mitzvah. After a person passes on, we can truly appreciate. So not only the people can access more, because as much as you know me, there's certain levels deep inside you can access, right? But when a person passes away, that block that we put up is not there anymore. So we're much more accessible to those who have passed, the people who we leave behind, and the person themselves. And now we get to a very interesting question. Do you think the soul feels bad that it's moving on? Do you think the soul wants to leave? Or does the soul feel pain when it leaves? Well, until now, it seems like no, right? Everyone concur? What?
It didn't want to come here to begin with.
Didn't want to come in, exactly. Didn't want to come here to begin with. So for sure, it wants to get out, right? Get out of Dodge, right? Interestingly, though, that's not the case.
Feels an attachment, though.
Okay, very good. Text number 2 and text 99. Sam, since your wife started the conversation...
He started the conversation.
So Deborah, read text number 2.
Deborah doesn't read out loud. Nothing is hard for the soul as a separation from the body.
The Zohar is the primary book of Kabbalah and is a little bit of an authority on soul, right? So I think we can take it as an authority. The Zohar says there's nothing more painful for the soul as a separation from the body. Now, question is, why is death chuppah. Why is death painful for the soul? So number one, all transitions are difficult. That means even if you're going to a better place and you're going to a whatever it is, your kid's first day at school, your first day at work, it's difficult. Even if it's a great job, great school, all beginnings are difficult. All transitions are difficult. And this is true also for the soul. Make sense? Number two is a little bit more powerful. Number two is, going back, and just to reiterate, and there's no transition like the transition of death, because that's final. And the guy they tell a story of a guy who was driving, got a very good skier. His relative was buried in another town, so he rented a GPS, gets into the car, as he's pulling into the cemetery, he says, "You've reached your final destination," right? So death is a very big transition because it's a final destination. Number two is body and soul are bound. That means Hashem, God, sent the soul down into the body for a reason. And when the soul descends, it becomes one with the body. So next week, let's not take questions now on the subject, about punishment, right, or consequences. Why does the soul get punished? Because what the body did. So obviously there's a connection between body and soul. So if there's a connection one way, then there's a connection the other way. Just like the body has the power to affect the soul, so too the soul has an attachment to the body. Very simply, because it's only through the body that the soul can accomplish anything. So you see here on text 3, on page 100. This tells us something very interesting. That when a person passes on, the soul doesn't just leave. There's the transition. You see here, it says, for 3 days the soul hovers over the body, thinking that it can return. After 3 days, the decomposition sets in, and it sees the face has changed, so it leaves. The soul and the body are a team. And anybody, you know, there's no I in team, but there is me, right? Anyone who threw a team, you ever see those interviews after a game? Now, you threw 7 touchdown passes. Oh, it's all about the team. Anybody who understands what a team is all about, working together, knows that when one of your team goes down, it hurts. So the soul feels pain for the body. And therefore, the soul doesn't just run away. There are 4 stages in the transition of the soul away from the body. The most severe is the first 3 days. For 3 days, the soul hovers over the body. If you would like, after class, I'll tell you a story of the Maharal who used this trick to save the Jewish people. Later. For 7 days, the soul goes between the grave and the house, as you see in text 4a. Text 4a and page 100. For 7 days, the soul goes between the house where it lived and the grave back to the house. After 7 days, this body is subjected to that which it is subjected. And then, you see in text 101, for 30 days, the soul and body are judged as one. And then for 12 months, after 12 months, the soul arises. So obviously, we see over here that there's a process. It's not just, the soul doesn't just leave. Graciela, go ahead.
Then, I'm not crazy because...
Okay.
Pam
Silver is the psychologist. She can certify pro or otherwise.
If the soul hovers around over the body for 3 days, I saw Christina, I saw my friend when she died, and then 3 days later, I saw her.
Okay, there's a story in text 6. There's a story in text 6. I also printed out a piece of Gemara that's really creepy.
Oh, yeah.
Sam, we learned this Gemara in Brachot about a guy who hears the conversations. So I printed it out over there. Yeah.
Can I just ask one other question?
Go ahead.
Add to what was just said. So you're saying for 3 days, is that
after death or after the burial?
After the burial. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a period called aninut, onein, mm-hmm. but it's yeah, during that time the soul hasn't gone anywhere. The soul is stuck.
So what she was saying, 3 days after the burial, not after the passing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, this text is assuming that we bury right away.
Right.
I mean, this text is written by the Gemara in Jerusalem Talmud. Jerusalem, they don't even leave the bodies overnight. In Israel, yeah. So
one and the same.
Yeah. So
same.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, it's the same. Yeah.
Then,
so it's assuming.
We get the person to visit us.
What?
Then my friend, she came to visit me.
Now, I'm going to tell you a story that I heard from my mother. I don't know if she wants me to share the story or not, but I'll share the story. What?
Yeah, it's on video.
Now it's on video. I didn't share the story yet. I'm going to make an argument for. You're not going to hear an argument against, because that's the gist of the class, that there is a connection. So I'll just tell you a story that happened with my mother. My grandfather went in for surgery. He was 77 years old. And went in for a small surgery, whatever it is. And I was a little kid. I'm the youngest in the family. So my mother had to leave. And it was a small thing. My parents were joking around with my grandfather. It was supposed to be a very small procedure. Something to do with his heart, but it wasn't a big deal. This is 1987. So she went home to take care of the family, and she figured, okay, afterwards, at night, when the procedure is over, she'll come back, and she'll speak to my grandfather. My grandfather passed away in the operating deal. And Mola says that she always felt bad she never got a chance to say goodbye. And I don't remember how long after my grandfather passed away. I think it was a few years. It was a while. I'm not sure if it's a few years. She had a dream. My grandfather came to her. I gave her a hug and a kiss. And I said, I love you and goodbye. And my grandfather passed away in 1987. She's never dreamt what my grandfather since. So, these stories are real.
These stories are real because I'm having quite an epiphany or whatever we want to call it. Because my mother passed away Friday night.
Yeah.
Sunday, Christmas Day, and they had no workers.
Right.
Did I know that I had to go? She must be buried on Monday. I was last in line, so it was
right.
On Tuesday.
Right.
It was such a profound emptiness of, and then Wednesday, we felt her again.
Right. A little later, we'll talk about what happens if you don't know. What happens if you don't know? But yeah, it's true. I mean, this is okay. Actually, you're going to give me a segue. Not yet, but no. I'm saying, but the mourning process correlates and corresponds to the transition process, which is very, very interesting. We'll get there in a sec. So there are four stages. So now, it's about, you see over here in text number 5, it says. Maimonides writes, 3 for crying, for weeping, 7 for eulogy. By the way, the number is Shiva, 7, which kind of goes against. So people do, oh, I'm doing a 3-day Shiva. I'm doing a 3-day 7. If I ask you what color was George Washington's white horse and you tell me black, Shiva, 7 is 7 is 7. That's the way it's supposed to be for the process. And then for 30 days, we have a ban here we go. For 30 days, we have restrictions. Restrictions are, a person can't cut his hair. A person can't wear new clothing. A person can't go to a celebration. Can't go on a business trip. And there's a few other matters what a person can't do the first 30 days. So after 7 days, a person rejoins society, but privately he still has signs of mourning. And in the 12 months, then after that, as you saw in text 4c, the soul ascends and that is it. And this explains something very interesting. Why are these four stages of mourning like that? Because it goes back to the four stages of a transition. If you remember, for 3 days the soul hovers over the grave. Well, for 3 days we weep. In fact, during the first 3 days, a person is not allowed to initiate a conversation. If a person says, He can't answer the phone hello. Even if a person says hello, he doesn't say hello back. He just starts talking. After the first 3 days, once the soul has moved on a little bit, we don't say hello, but if a person says hello to us, we say hello back. And after that, 30 days, the soul has moved on a little more, so there's still mourning. We can't, you know, beautify ourselves and take care of ourselves. But as we have some restrictions. And then, as we see here, it's very interesting. Now, some people might think that the concept of mourning is only for the mourners, for the family. What happens if there are no mourners? There are no family. Do we still have the concept of Shiva? Very interesting story, text number 6, page 102. A man died, didn't have any mourners. Rabbi Yehuda organized that people should sit in his house and say Kaddish. Now, if we're here to comfort the family, make the people feel better, then why did Rabbi Yehuda do that? Obviously, the concept of mourning and the saying Kaddish is for the soul also. So as you see over here, we mourn not only for the departed soul, we mourn with the departed soul. We are accompanying the departed soul on its journey when we do the proper steps of mourning. Okay? Now, before we go on to the next section, any questions? Yes?
Okay. 3 days is such a little time.
I'm sorry?
3 days. I would cry for a month.
No. 3 days. Okay. Doesn't mean literally weeping. You can't cry. It doesn't mean you have to. It means that for 3 days we focus on the weeping. That should be your focus. You know, I remember hearing, we have some books over here. There's a book over there, but it's called Why. I think it's in that book where a father lost a young son. He talks about, I think, the process of the Shiva. There's another book over there, Mourning in Halacha. It talks about the way the Jewish practice is set up. It's very therapeutic. So if you're forced to cry, and then you can begin the healing process. So you're not distracted by TV and all those other things. As you know, we cover the mirrors, right, and all that. So you're forced to grieve. So in those 3 days, you're forced to grieve. You can't get any other distractions, like regular conversation. Okay? All right. So now that we focused on what happens to the soul, let's look at what happens. What do you mean?
What we did was spend time about the mourning and whatever. We didn't go what happens to the soul.
Okay, so what we spoke about is the soul's departure from the body. Now, what happens once it gets up there? That's gonna be next week. That we can, unless you want to be here for 3 hours.
No, but just real quick. The 12 months where it ascends and descends until it rises, right?
Yeah.
Does that mean that for 12 months the soul? The neshama is where?
The neshama is judged and dealt with according to its actions. So we don't know exactly. Some people, you know, they need, you know, we say Kaddish for 11 months. Anybody know why we say Kaddish for 11 months, not 12?
Yeah.
Larry, go ahead.
Because no soul is considered so bad that he has to be born for the full 12 months.
Okay. Oh, well, you're right. But the reason is because the child is the one saying Kaddish. So imagine if a child testified about his own father. My father is so terrible, he needed 12 months of purgatory. Right? It's not really respectful. Even if a person's father was a miserable guy. So, therefore, the standard doesn't make a difference if a person's father was the Rebbe or was a nobody. Everybody's 11 months. Now, so during that 12 months is the time of judgment and all that. Now again, next week we'll deal with heaven, hell, reincarnation, and all that. Okay, we're focusing more, like I said in the beginning of class, down here. In this world, in this realm, what happens? Okay? All right, good? Okay, so now that we spoke about the soul leaving the body, and the soul's holy, what about the body? Is the body holy? You've heard this expression, holy cow, right? But is the body holy? Does the body have any holiness? Yeah, Larry?
Yeah, it's the receptacles. And all the receptacles we've been taught, we can't just destroy them if they've been used for a holy purpose.
Exactly. Okay. So what we're going to speak about over here is not...
So often, so. Yeah.
So now it's interesting. By Jewish burial, it's very important that we, you know, after the service in the chapel, by other people, they just go home and they start eating. By us, we actually accompany the mace. We accompany the deceased. It's very, very important. In fact, if you look in the Mishnah, Brachot, it talks about if a person is involved in a funeral, he's just following, walking behind the coffin, he does not have to say Shema. And Shema is the biblical commandment. So we see over here that respecting the dead is very, very important. And here, let's talk about the body. You see over here, go to text 7a. Before we do that, actually, I forgot. Oh, recap. Oops, sorry. A death is soul freed. All right, sorry about that. Okay. How, now that you say the body is holy, how holy is the body? If let's say, God forbid, hey Pam, we needed you before. Someone wanted to know if they're crazy. So let's say, God forbid, there's a building on fire and there's a Torah scroll in the building. Are you obligated to risk your life to rescue the Torah scroll? Torah scroll is the holiest object in the world. Right? In fact, one of the reasons why we fast on the 17th day of Tammuz is because a Torah scroll was burnt. That's one of the five reasons why we fast. So does a person risk their life to rescue a Torah scroll?
Gene Wilder did in The Frisco Kid.
And since Hollywood reflects reality, right? My hero. Okay, Nu? So, yes or no?
No.
No. No. Is that unanimous? Any yeses?
Yes.
You say yes. Okay. The answer is no. Sorry. I know I set you up for that one. We see over here, it's at text 7a, the Gemara says, Doug, read text 7a, page 103.
The one who's present at the time of a person's passing is required to tear his clothing. This is because a person's passing is likened into the burning.
So we see here, the person's passing is like a Torah scroll. So what's the comparison between a person and a Torah scroll? What's the comparison? What God did for our lives is He gave us the ability, like Larry said, to make physical things holy. That means when you take a piece of hide from a cow, you could decide to make a nice pair of shoes, right? Gucci, right? To make shoes. Sorry, not into the shoe thing, right? Or a nice purse, or you can process that hide and write the name of God. And once you write the name of God, the parchment is holy. And you should know there's an interesting halacha that says if something bad happens to a Torah, we have to tear our clothing twice, one for the letters, and one for the white behind. In fact, Kabbalah explains that the white part of the Torah scroll is even holier than the letters. That's again, it's Kabbalistic, not the scope of this class. But we see over here that just like a Torah scroll is embedded with holiness, once you write God's name, so too, when no matter how miserable you think you are, we've all done many good things, right? No matter how bad you might think you are, we've all done many good things. That means we all have holiness. We're all holy. So our bodies are holy. And that's why you see in text 7 on page 103, the Ramban, Nachmanides, says, he explains, Israel, you want to read text number 7?
Nachmanides, of blessed memory, explains that the soul in the body is like the names of God inscribed on the parchment of Torah scroll.
Right, so when writing God's holy names on parchment, the parchment becomes independently holy. So because it serves as a container for the soul, the physical body actually becomes holy. And therefore, when a person passes away, it's not like we're very cavalier with the body. A person has to treat the body with ultimate respect. In every Jewish community, there's something called the Chevra Kadisha, the holy brotherhood or community. And when I've been involved in this, But they prepare a body for death. They wash the body, they put the body in the mikveh. And it's a very, very serious time. It's not, you're not joking around. And even though they might have seen it a bunch of times, you see here, the role of the Chevra Kadisha. So no casual conversation is allowed. The only allowed to speak if something needs to be spoken regarding the preparation for the burial. The body is always covered. Modesty of the deceased is protected. The body is never placed face down. You're not allowed to pass anything over the body. It's not a table. It's not an object. And the body is never left alone. There's a concept of a shomer, an honor guard. When a person passes away, the body is always kept company. Usually, you should be saying Tehillim, Psalms, in the same room or another room. This shows that Judaism, the body is holy. If it wasn't holy, we wouldn't care what happened to it. Doug, I had a question.
So it wasn't clear when I said yes and everybody said no.
Okay.
That if there was one building and the Torah was burning, and in another building there was a person who needed help to survive.
Okay.
You're saying that the Torah should go before the person?
No. What I'm saying is even more. Let's say there's a building with a Torah inside and no people. There's no people in the equation, only a Torah. A person is not allowed to risk his life to save the Torah.
That's what I said.
Yeah, okay. Okay, fine.
Everybody
sorry.
Said something.
Right. I said, sorry for confusing you. Hey, you stand correct.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
What about when there's no bodies, like soldiers, that they never come back, and they are killed in the war?
Okay. What
but
about?
What happened, you know, how do you mourn somebody who you never saw
the
body?
Okay, the exact mourning, is, I think we're going to deal with more in five. But we'll get that in a second, because when we talk about when a person doesn't get buried, about cremation and all that, later in the lesson. Okay.
Sorry, real quick. Yeah. The body's never left alone. Is there a deeper reason for that?
You see, look at text number 9. This is a quote from... So Gesher HaChaim, it's an authoritative book on death. It says that if you care about something, you put it in your safe, right? He says, we maintain watch over the dead out of respect. For if we leave the body alone, it would appear as if we abandoned it like a utensil we no longer use. I mean, this testifies to the fact that the body, regardless of the soul, is holy. And therefore has to be treated like you would treat a Torah scroll even more. We see in text number 10, Moshe Sofer, who was a son of a very, very famous rabbinical authority. Ellen, want to read number 10? Page 105.
Just as there's no difference between a complete Torah scroll and one letter from the Torah scroll, as both must be treated with the utmost respect, it is forbidden to record disrespect to even a single bone from sacred bodies that were created in God's image.
Okay, so this is why... Who here has heard of the organization called Zaka? Mentioned last week. Okay. There's a video explaining what they are exactly in the email also. So it's very important that a person be buried complete because the whole body is holy. So therefore, and this, by the way, is not only for terrorists, also by accidents. Or for example, when a person has an operation, so any sheets or something that has any bodily fluid is buried with the deceased. It's very important because the entire person's body is holy.
I wasn't raising my hand.
I'm sorry, okay.
But that also answers her question. In Israel, when there's an attack or a war or something like that, they make sure.
Right, saying so. This Zaka, they deal with accidents and they deal with terror.
Soldiers also.
Yeah, in fact, the Israeli army has been known to risk their lives to recover a body. In fact, if you look at the news, you can Google it. Israel has traded live terrorists for the body of a soldier. Okay. Why? Because the body of a Jew is very, very holy.
So you're saying Zaka organization.
Right? Zaka, Z-A-K-A. They recover the body part. Not a pretty sight. Yeah, go ahead.
What about the donation of organs?
Okay.
At this point.
Okay, that's I had a feeling that question was coming. what do we say about the donation of organs? Okay, so this, by the way, is a subject dealt with in another course, which I gave a few years ago, called Medicine and Morals, right? And so, very, very briefly, there is halakha guidelines that make it allowed. As basically, it has to be from a cadaver. It cannot be when a person's alive.
Don't mention when you're alive.
No, when a person, because even if they're clinically, even if they're brain dead, the problem is clinically brain dead is not so much recognized by halakhic authorities. Why that is, again, that's a complex issue. But there is a card. There's a card people carry, halakhic organ donation. So it does exist, okay? All right, if you remind me, I'll try to send articles. All right, So now that we've discussed how holy the body is, now we can get to the matter of Jewish burial. If a body is very holy, it's very, very important that the body is buried according to Jewish law. You see, King Solomon said, text 11, page 105, man goes to his everlasting home, and the mourners go about in the street, and the dust returns to the earth, and his spirits returns to God who gave it. Those are the very key words, who gave it. That means we are a custodian. As much as you are, as much as you think you're the boss of you, and right, out of the fear, I have little kids, right? You're not the boss of me. Right? So we tell God all the time, you're not the boss of me, you can't tell me what to do. Well, the fact of the matter is, our bodies, our lives and our bodies, we are only custodians. And God asks us to care for it. And therefore, we're not allowed to damage it. And we're supposed to give it back the same way God gave it to us. So, you know, I heard this idea. One of the reasons why there's Tara, why there's a purification process, a washing process, before we bury. Because you want to give the body back in the most pristine condition as we got it. That's why there's a Tara. And we see here, text number 12, Reb Chaim Vital. Reb Chaim Vital was the student of the Arizal, the greatest authority of Kabbalah. Pam, text 12, read for us.
To catch up to you, I was reading the other. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Man's body comes from the earth, and it is with him as a deposit. From death, the deposit must be returned to the earth from where it came.
Okay. That's a verse from Genesis, from the book of Bereshit. After Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge, and God said, "Okay, now you will no longer be immortal. You will die." And says, "Just like I took you from the dust, so too you will be returned to the dust." In fact, in the story of Genesis, in the book of Genesis, we find quite a few stories of dealing with burial. So anybody can, without me giving it away, anybody can tell me some stories in the Torah about burial? No. Okay. I'll start off, while you're thinking, I'll start off telling you a very interesting medrash. It says when Cain killed Abel, first two brothers, Adam didn't know what to do with the body. He was crying. And the medrash tells us something interesting, that Adam witnessed a bird. It was a raven. Thank you. It was a raven. He saw it burying another bird. So he understood that that's what he should do with the body. That's how the concept of burial was introduced. In fact, this is off the subject. But if you come to me afterwards, I'll tell you how Cain killed Abel in the first place. How do you know how to kill him? Anyway, so we see here. There are many examples. Whoops. Sorry. Got ahead of myself. Video. Sorry about that.
The mystics tell us that the divine human soul is a part of God above. But the soul does not remain above. Instead, it descends into a mortal casing, a temporal home of flesh and blood. This unlikely alliance allows God's light to shine within our bodies, and we can use our minds, hearts, and limbs to perform the missions for which God has sent us to this world. And so the body also becomes holy. The treatment of the body of the deceased is therefore governed by strict regulations of Jewish law.
In Jewish life, death is a new beginning, it's not the end.
Zvi Gluck is the director of Amudim, a New York-based Jewish crisis intervention center, which is frequently called upon to assist in meeting the requirements of Jewish law for the dignified treatment and proper burial of the deceased.
We will go to any extent to help people when it comes to burying a loved one.
Burying a body intact, as it was at the time of passing, is essential for the dignity of both body and soul. Therefore, autopsies and embalming and similar invasive procedures are prohibited, besides for the most extenuating of circumstances.
A few years ago, I received a call about a fellow that passed away in Sierra Leone. There was a robbery involved, a potential homicide. The medical examiner told us it was a heart attack. Nobody knew the truth, and there was nobody there with this fellow. The first thing we did is try to figure out how to bring the nifter back, the body back, so we can bury him. We reached out to the American Embassy. There was a power outage. It took us an extra few hours to track someone down who could get there. They ended up telling us how remote the area was, where this hospital was, which wasn't even really a hospital. There was no running water or electricity. They couldn't get anyone by phone. We had to hire somebody to drive in the next major area just to tell them not to do anything. Then we needed to work with paying the hospital before they would release this person for burial. Then there was an issue with getting documentation proving who the wife was, that she could claim this person so that she could bring him in for burial. Then there was the issue of getting the local government to agree to not do the autopsy. And then we had to get the airline to agree to not do the embalming. We were told that based on the amount of travel that would have to be done, this person would not be able to be brought to Jewish burial for the following week, meaning keeping him there for another Shabbos in Africa. And then all of a sudden somebody showed up claiming that he was the next of kin because they heard that this person had a lot of money and assets. So now they wanted to tie it up in a local court battle. And finally, by the time we brought this person in for proper Jewish burial was Wednesday. Thank God we were able to object to all autopsies and invasive procedures and things of that nature, but it was still 4 days of non-stop battles where every day there was another hurdle and hoop to jump over, just to be able to follow the tradition in accordance with Jewish law.
After a lifetime of marriage, the detachment of soul and body should not come as a bitter divorce, but as a gentle and dignified return to their respective sources.
Okay. Let's get back. Let's get out of here. Oops, wrong way. All right, so you see here in biblical burial, Adam and Eve, Adam and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob and Leah, all buried in the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron. In fact, Yaakov makes a whole big thing about bringing his bones back. Joseph wants to be buried there. It's a whole fight between Jacob and Esau about being buried there. We see a very important, a big focus of the Torah, of the holiest book, being put on being buried. It says when Moses passed away, God himself buried Moses, Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem, which is visited, Joseph's tomb in Shechem. There's a very, very strong focus on having a proper Jewish burial. In fact, we see the story of Ruth, you see in text number 13. You see on page 106, manual, read text number 13.
Ruth responded, "Do not press me to leave thee, to return to Moab, rather than follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried."
Okay. So the story of Ruth is that Ruth's mother-in-law is Naomi, and her sons are married to two women named Ruth and Orpah, and the two sons die, and Naomi says, "I have nothing here, I'm going back to Israel." They were in a land called Moab. So the first daughter-in-law says, "Okay, I'm going, Orpah." And Ruth says, "No, I'm coming with you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you die, wherever you're buried, I'm going to be buried." Why state that? Because obviously there's a Jewish way to go about it. The Jewish way has always been burial, as opposed to the other societies around the world. The Jewish way has always been burial. Now, how do we know that it's a commandment to bury a person from the Torah? Now, in the Torah, I'm sure you know there's a concept of capital punishment. Very theoretical, pretty much impossible. The Talmud says if a court murders or kills one person, in 70 years, it's considered a bloodthirsty court. But let's say it does, okay? But after they execute the person, they have to hang up, they have to hang the man up for a very short time, and then it says you're not allowed to leave him hanging there. You see text 14, page 107. You shall surely bury him on the same day. Now the way the Torah works, the Torah always teaches us the most extreme example, and then we work our way back, right? So the Torah is telling us over here that this guy, who, if you know the criteria to get capital punishment, meaning there was witnesses and there was warning, and he acknowledged warning, he's a really, really bad guy. And this miserable guy, he has to get buried. So how much more so? Everybody who's not this person has to be buried. And yet we find something very interesting and disturbing. Used to be everyone knew all Jews were buried. Now the numbers of cremations are going higher. As you see, in the 70s, this is in America. Oops, that was supposed to come second. There you go. In 1960, 3.5% of the Jews were getting cremated. In 2014, 46%. They say by 2030, 70% of the Jewish people will be cremated. Why?
Finance.
Finance, okay. So, one of the problems, we'll deal with finances in a second, later, I gotta say. But one of the problems is that you have Jewish organizations offering this service to people as a Jewish service. I was involved in a story where a guy called me up, his mother-in-law passed away, no money, and whatever, he wanted to do cremation. So myself and some other rabbis, we said, you know, we'll put together the money, you know, to have it buried, you know, we're trying to save money, so whatever. The family was being very, very difficult. And in the end, they found a Jewish place. And the guy told me, yeah, we had a Jewish ceremony and everything. I said, where was she buried? Oh, she wasn't there. I said, I thought you said you had a Jewish service. This is one of the problems. The problem is people don't know. That's one of the reasons why you're here, is to get better information. People don't know that cremation is not the Jewish way. That it's not okay. And if people would know how important it is, then money wouldn't be a factor. We all spend money on things we want to spend money on, right? We all splurge on, you know, Disney or the Bahamas. But let's go through some information. The problem with cremation goes against two very core beliefs. Number one, as we said before, our bodies don't belong to us. So we can go damage something that doesn't belong to us. Our body belongs to God. And we have to do with it what He asks. We can't go and damage something that doesn't belong to us. Number two, one of the core fundamental beliefs in Judaism, in fact, it's one of the 13 principles of faith. Maimonides writes 13 principles of faith. There are 613 commandments and all these theological concepts, and he narrows it down to 13. Number 12, the body will be resurrected. That when Mashiach comes, there's going to be a time. A great man is going to usher in a tremendous time. And after that time, at some period, all the dead are going to be resurrected. In fact, there's a verse in Daniel that says, those sleeping in the earth will wake up. There are many references in the Torah for this. The problem is, if a person's cremated, there's no resurrection of the dead. There's no body to resurrect. So when a person willingly, key word here is willingly, because there are many people in Jewish history that were cremated unwillingly. Like 70 years ago, the Nazis were cremating. The key word here is willingly. Willingly, with the knowledge of how bad it really is, that he's going against that fundamental belief. Everyone okay with that? Or anyone want to scream at me? No? Okay. That means God cares about the body. Well, let's take a step back. God cares about whatever is holy, right? God equals holy. God loves holy, doesn't like not holy. So God's telling you He loves the body, so the body is holy. So that means we can't destroy something holy. I heard a rabbi say, there's a link for a very good class. I hope you spend the time listening to it. By Rabbi Doron Kornbluth. And he says, his line was, we burn garbage, we don't burn things we care about. And that's a fact. And you'll see in the email, there's actually a video. Now some people think cremation is better for the environment. It's not. It's really not. Environmentalists actually say that the chemicals they put into the body when they embalm them, or the energy they use when they cremate a body, it's very bad for the environment. And when they put them in these metal caskets, that metal stays in the earth forever. The environmentalists now are pushing for what's called a green burial. You know what a green burial is? Wooden casket, because it decomposes, right? And nothing else. Huh? Wouldn't you know it? Judaism has been green for 3,500 years. So everything the environmentalists are saying we got to do, it's now we're doing. So if I ask you a question, this is a very powerful question. No matter how non-observant or practicing you are, everybody who's a Jew at some level is proud to be a Jew. If I asked you what your final statement about your Judaism is, would you want your final statement to be, I don't believe in Judaism? Of course not. Well, people who don't understand that when they choose cremation, it's exactly the statement they're making. They're going against. So it's not, I'm trying to stress this point. It's not just a custom, something on the side of Judaism that's okay, it's something we do, that's the Jewish way. No, it's more than that. This is a core principle and a core belief in Judaism, that the body is holy. So therefore, when a person makes sure, spends the money, and a person spends the money for the Jewish burial, he's making a very strong statement about what he believes. And that's why it says when a person who's cremated, there's no shiva, there's no cemetery. You know, the cemetery it's still kaddish, for all these reasons. Now, here we're going to get into a little bit of a legal issue, Jewish.
Does the soul suffer?
100%. The soul suffers because there's no transition period. The whole concept of mourning is that the soul, it says the soul looks for the body and it's not there because the soul has that connection. We said in the beginning of the class, there's a very strong relationship. When the body is destroyed, the soul has, so the soul in the beginning, it fluctuates between, it can't be, there's no representation in the physical world and there's no integration in the spiritual world. It's in limbo, it's going back and forth. As you saw in that text, for the first 12 months it's going up and down. But as the soul, the body decomposes. Now, I once read something very powerful. That the question is, why is it when we get old, our bodies become more frail? And why?
The biblical reason or the biological reason?
The Kabbalistic reason.
Just so they can tell the difference between an old guy and a young guy.
Right. So you should be able to get into the parks, you know, should be able to qualify for Social Security. So Kabbalah explains the reason is because as we age, in fact, it speaks in Kabbalah, about 30 days before a person passes away, there's already something is missing, the light of his soul is gone from his head. But even before that, as a person gets old, his soul is slowly leaving his body. Therefore, the body weakens. So when you're young, you feel your body a lot more. You don't care about your soul. You care about your temporary body stuff. When you get older, you care about your soul stuff, which is eternal. So the process of the burial allows for the soul to transition away from the body. Now, we'll talk about there's never a full transition, which is why we go to the gravesite. But the when a person has cremation, the soul suffers. There's no easy transition. But what if somebody says, I don't care, I want a cremation, I want to do what I want to do. What do we do? Do we have to listen? As you see in text 15a, the Gemara says it's a mitzvah to listen to the wishes of the deceased. So do we listen?
No. You say no.
But you should know, by the way, I read in preparing for this class, there's a very interesting story that took place in New York or New Jersey of a guy who was a religious man who was in a nursing home, old age home in New York. He was religious, went to shul every day, you know, blah, 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 blah. Never left a will, which, by the way, connects to last week, why it's very important for us to leave a will. And he died. And his brother lived in California, wasn't religious, and demanded that the body be cremated. So the owner of the nursing home was a religious man, said, listen, I know your brother. He was religious. He wouldn't want to be buried this way. They went to court. It was a big court case. And, you know, who do we listen to? The whole next of kin. It was a whole question. Could a friend be considered a next of kin? It was a very interesting court case. You can read about it online. I'll try to send out the link for that. Okay. So the question is, if a person makes a demand that goes against the Torah, do we listen? So Maimonides writes in text 15b, no, we don't. It says, if a person requests not to be buried, we disregard that request. This is because burial is a mitzvah. And even if you say you want to go against the mitzvah, we don't listen to you. Because deep inside, you don't want to do the mitzvah. So that means, because the body doesn't belong to you, if let's say, for example, I ask you to hit her, right? You can listen to me? She's waiting for an answer. Right. So, obviously, no, because you don't belong to me. So your body doesn't belong to you. So therefore, you can't decide to do something that doesn't belong to you. So just like, for example, you see over here, do not do unto others. So just as one may not harm another live person, so too, you're not a person not allowed to harm a body, even if that body is yours. Number two, when a person passes away, they have a totally separate set of priorities. What's important to you today, when a person passes away, it's not important. So there's a story actually, well, it's debatable if it's true or not, but it's a great story. Well, we're running low on time, so again, afterwards, if you want to stay, we'll have an added session. Where a guy wanted to be buried not according to the Jewish law, and the family went to the rabbi, and the rabbi said, maybe when he was present physically, he wanted, but where he is now, where the soul is now in appreciation of what's true and holy, the body, this person wants to be buried according to Jewish law. So even though a person might have said that, a person might have said before that he wants to violate the Torah, we don't listen. So it's very interesting, by the way. And again, I don't know if this is a correlation or not. I know this is very controversial. But the fact that your body doesn't belong to you, I wonder, it's thinking out loud, how would the rabbis, let's say, you know, the concept of abortion. What did the woman say? It's my body, don't tell me what to do with it. Well, the Torah is saying, no, it's not. You can't do whatever you want to your body. I mean, that concept just came up in abortion, but it doesn't only apply to abortion. Right? So, interesting how, I wonder how, if anybody wants to do some research, how that would apply. And you should know, this doesn't only apply in the negative, it also applies in the positive. In a few centuries ago, there was a practice of people would hurt themselves, they would punish themselves in order to serve God. Because intuitively, the less physical you are, the more spiritual you are. Right? Make sense? Right? The less you eat, you know, donuts and corned beef sandwiches, the easier it is to feel, you know, holy. Right? Holy people always eat, you know, I don't know, curds and whey. Right? They're always eating like, you know, bad stuff, oatmeal, right? When you say, like Jackie Mason had a joke, you know, he says that the healthy people, they're eating carrots and they can't see, you go into GNC, everybody, it's a crack at the target, you walk into a deli, hello, right? So people actually would hurt themselves. They would sit outside in the freezing cold in like the 50 degree weather, you know, we're flirting, right? This is Russia, Ukraine, and they would sit on ant piles, people would hurt themselves. The Baal Shem Tov came and said, you're not allowed to do that. Even if it's in the service of God, your body doesn't belong to you. You're not allowed to hurt yourself. And this is one of the reasons why the Torah said you're not allowed to get a tattoo. See in text number 16, Do not place tattoos on your bodies. Some people, by the way, say if a person has a tattoo, they can't have a Jewish burial. That's not true. There's not one Jewish source for that. It doesn't exist. It's a made up. We have enough craziness. We don't have to add.
Urban legend.
Yeah, it's very prevalent, but it's not true.
But people think it's no.
See, that's why you got to ask questions. It says Pirkei Avot, Ethics of a Father, says a bashful person doesn't learn. Got to ask questions. Not only that, even if a person does have a tattoo, they don't have to remove it in order to get a Jewish burial. It is what it is. We don't obligate, if a person becomes religious, we don't obligate them to remove the tattoo. It is what it is. Okay. So now that we dealt with the soul's transition and the holiness of the body and the importance of the burial, so now we can talk about the people left behind visiting the grave. Before we do that, I have to present one of my favorite. I'm sorry, administering and granting one of my favorite jokes.
Why did you die? Why did you die? Why did you die?
Pardon me, sir. I've been watching you here at the grave for over a half hour. I guess the deceased was a close relative.
No, I never met him. Why did you die? Why did you die?
Sir, you say you never met him and you carry on like this. Then tell me, who is buried here?
My wife's first husband.
Sorry, it's an old Jewish joke. I had to put it in. Anyway.
I think the men are laughing more than the women.
So I didn't have time to look for a wife. I didn't have time to look for a wife one. Okay. So now, visiting the grave, number one, it's about respect. You say that, you know, we didn't forget about you. You know, it's about respect. But number two, it's also the fact that a person's not forgotten. And most importantly, it's that there's still a presence of the soul in the grave. Otherwise, why would you go there? You see text number 17. The Zohar writes, the nefesh, if you remember from the beginning of the class, the nefesh, which is the biological soul, the lowest part of the soul, the part that intimate with the body the most, is present in the grave. It is among the living and is acquainted with their pain. Listen to this, what the Zohar writes. At a time of need, when the family comes, the soul ascends and asks for mercy. Now, I made a wife joke and now my wife is coming. So the grave site is because the nefesh is present in the grave. Even after the 12 months, there's still a remnant of the nefesh there. Which, if you might be familiar with the concept of going to a family, also to a holy person to pray. If you know of Chabad, thousands and thousands of people go every single year, tens of thousands, maybe even over 100,000. To the Rebbe's grave in Queens. We ask for blessings and everything else. Why do we have to go over there? Well, it's because there's a remnant of the nefesh at that point. It's a very good place for communication. Of course, we said that a person could communicate anywhere, but here is a very, very important place. And there are many stories of people who went to the Rebbe's grave, and you know they made a prayer and the prayers were answered. Many stories. You know, tell a joke of an old lady goes to the rabbi, and you know they're discussing burial plans, and she tells the rabbi, "I want to be buried in Bloomingdale's." She says, "Bloomingdale's? That's not a Jewish burial." She says, "Why do you want to be buried in Bloomingdale's?" Says, "At least I know my daughters will come visit me twice a week." Right? So it's very, very important that we understand that the grave is a place that we can communicate. Not only that, the deceased, the ones who have passed, appreciate when we come. Check out the text number 18, page 110. Let's get someone to read. Judy, want to read text 18. 18. Or at least the first paragraph.
There was once a community that wished to uproot and move to a different location. One of the deceased of that community appeared in a dream to a member of the community and said, "Please don't leave us, or we take pleasure when you visit the cemetery." Barzillai the Gileadite, forgive the pronunciation, said, "I would like to die in my own city." He said this because the dead are delighted when we, their loved ones, visit their grave sites and request goodness for their souls. This improves their condition in heaven, and when we make requests, the departed pray for us.
So this story, Barzillai, was when King David was almost overthrown by his son, Absalom, and during the rebellion, he ran away. So this Barzillai gave him shelter and gave him food. So when King David won the war, and he went back to Jerusalem, he welcomed Barzillai to come. You know, he'll be a member of his cabinet. Barzillai said, "No, I want to stay where I am to be buried next to my loved ones." So we see here that there's a concept of communication. In fact, I printed enough copies. You can pick up a copy of the tractate Brachot, where this guy goes to sleep in a cemetery, and he hears about a conversation between two souls about what the weather is going to be like, you know, depending on agriculture. And there's a whole story there. You'll see it's printed out. It's quite lengthy. That's why I didn't put it on the slideshow. Afterwards, the souls say, "Okay, we got to stop talking because the living, they're picking up on our conversation." So the point of the class is there's definitely a connection between those of us here and those who have passed on. And that connection is very, very much present at the grave. And as you see here, the departed, they are pleased to receive visitors. So before we end off, we said, I want to share with you a letter from the Rebbe. You see text number 19, letter of the Rebbe. To a woman I actually grew up with. She was in the same shul. Her husband, who just passed away a few months ago, was a genius. And she lost her mother, her father, and her mother-in-law in a few-year period. Very, very quick. She wrote a letter to the Rebbe. She wrote an emotional letter to the Rebbe saying how she's alone. She's depressed. And text 19, page 111. He said, "I received your letters in which you write about your emotional upsets." And the Rebbe goes on to say, "Another fundamental point to remember, which has been direct bearing in the letter, is that we believe in the survival of the soul." So if you believe in the eternity of the soul, it's quite a lengthy letter. And again, I encourage you to read it in its entirety. Says the last paragraph, "In view of the above, it is clear that even after the physical body has disintegrated and disappeared from view, it is still possible to bring joy and benefit to the soul, which has noted above not only survive, but does so on a higher level. And all things which had previously brought joy and pleasure to one's mind will continue to do so even after they physically no longer here." So when a person passes, there's the transition. And it's very important that we make sure to have the burial. Which is, you know, interesting. There's a line written, I forgot, Gemara or Medrash, it says that buying a plot, burial plot, is a good blessing for a long life. Don't ask me how that works. It seems opposite, but that's what it says. It says buying a burial plot is a blessing for a long life.
Oh, we're
going to
live a long time.
Good. We need you for the meeting. Okay, so learning exercise, you see on page 113. Write down anything that a lesson that resonated with you most. If you'd like to share it, please do. Is there a deceased person with whom you strengthen your bond of love? What step will you take to do so? But as I said, the story in the beginning, even if a person is not physically here, we still have this ability to connect with this person. And it's only a question of plugging in. You know, me being a rabbi, I'm in the spiritual business, meaning that sometimes things look like, you know, things are not going to work out. And somehow, when you're doing the holy work, things have a way of coming around. Okay, thank you so much for coming. And next week, We'll talk about what happens when the soul goes up. Oh, sorry. Key points. You right? Sorry. It is customary to visit the grave on Rosh Hashanah before Yom Kippur. That's right. Even when the body disappeared from view, one can still bring joy. So only deeper. Sorry.
Key points. Lesson 3. 1. Nefesh and Ruach are two of the soul's components.